This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
In Pakistan, floodwaters are receding. Now contaminated water is the dire problem.
Anytime you go to these health units, you are surrounded by an ocean of mothers, and they all are carrying children who are sick.
Also today, the U.S. responds to a North Korean missile test. Then North Korea answers back with another missile.
North Korean statements say explicitly they are doing this to make the U.S. and its South Korean allies back off.
That does not seem to be happening. I'm Marco Werman, plus a Nobel Prize for Literature goes to French writer Annie Ernaux for the way she captivated her readers and translator in her best-known book, The Years.
The Years left me with a sort of blueprint of how memory works. Time and memory are always unpredictable, I think.
All that and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us on this Thursday. We begin today in Pakistan. Extreme flooding in many parts of the country have swept away houses, schools, even entire villages. The flood waters have largely receded, but in their wake, in the south of Pakistan, a new distressing chapter, waterborne diseases are exploding, making people sick. Joining us now from the capital, Islamabad, is Catherine Vibel. She works for the UNICEF mission in Pakistan. Catherine, describe the health problem now following the floods. How many people are getting sick, in your estimation?
So as of today, we estimate that there are nearly 10 million children who are at risk and who need immediate life-saving assistance. So you have many children now who are suffering of acute diarrhea, children also suffering from malaria, from dengue fever. We have heard that there might be cases of cholera as well. So these are children, families, and they have absolutely nothing. And when they don't have water, they have to drink whatever they find. And of course, a lot of them get sick. And it's, of course, threatening the lives of the younger children.
So you've been in the field, Catherine, visited several centers where the internally displaced people have sought refuge from the floods. Describe what it's been like traveling to an encampment and what you found when you got there.
It's a very striking sight. Like, the bridges are gone. The roads, I mean, we're talking big roads, highway style, are completely gone. And so you have to drive in 4x4 along the road to be able to reach communities, which for some have been cut off for weeks. Very often, the only dry part of the landscape is the road itself. And you have this road with trucks driving on it. And all around, as far as the eye can see, is only water. And many families have not found any other place to stay but along the road. So literally 1 meter, even less, from the wheels of trucks, you have children who are sleeping on the ground with their families. They are often less than a meter away from the stagnant flood water. They are trying to get cooler by getting into the water, which is riddled with diseases. So it's a very, very alarming situation.
Those are great details. I really have a clear picture of these people camped out on these elevated roads and surrounded by water, almost like a moat. I mean, you're talking about waterborne disease here, and we know the major cause, kind of writ large, is poor sanitation. What were you seeing in those encampments in terms of transmission of disease?
So, you know, UNICEF has set up more than 70 health mobile units in camps where people have been given tents, and also along the roads. And it's very striking. Anytime you go to these health units, you are surrounded by an ocean of mothers, and they all are carrying children who are sick. You have lots of very young children who are suffering from acute watery diarrhea. You have many children who are malaria. All of them have skin conditions. All of them literally eaten alive by mosquitoes at night. And you have also a huge issue with malnutrition. These are areas where a very vulnerable population was already living before these floods hit. And even if UNICEF right now is delivering 1 million of drinking water every day, we still cannot meet the needs because the needs are absolutely huge. Again, we're speaking about nearly 10 million children who are at risk. And if something is not done very soon, if resources are not granted, we're going to see children dying, which is really terrible.
The floods destroyed some 1,700 healthcare facilities in Pakistan. So, I mean, UNICEF can't do it all. Who can fill in for those missing services?
So UNICEF is working with the government of Pakistan and with local partners on the ground and trying to provide health and nutrition services to the families. This is basically an emergency which is underfunded. And so far, there's, you know, maybe 15% of the appeal of UNICEF and the United Nations which has been funded. So the needs are huge and it's really, really important to act now if we want to save lives.
Catherine Vibel is Chief of Advocacy and Communication for UNICEF in Pakistan, updating us on the growing problem of disease transmission following historic floods there. She joined us from Islamabad. Catherine, thank you and good luck with your efforts there.
Many thanks.
To say that ice hockey is Canada's national sport just does not fully express a country's passion for the game. Many kids learn to skate shortly after they learn to walk. There are amateur hockey associations for kids 18 and under in practically every town in every province. But Hockey Canada, the national governing board for these junior players, is at the center of a growing sexual assault scandal. It involves charges of secret funds and cover-ups. And now Hockey Canada's biggest sponsors are withdrawing their support. From Toronto, Anita Elash explains what's going on.
Wins that foul in the corner. Feeds it back at the point. Timmins in, looking for a second score! Steve Bergen gives Canada the lead!
Canada's junior hockey team did the country proud in 2018, scoring this gold medal win at the World Junior Hockey Championships against Sweden with less than 2 minutes left in the final game. But Canadians have a different view after learning that several members of that team had been accused of sexually assaulting a 20-year-old woman in a hotel room and that Hockey Canada had paid the victim more than $2.5 million to keep the case out of court. That money came from amateur player registration fees that were diverted into a secret fund set up to deal with sexual assault allegations and other claims that aren't covered by insurance. Parents like Teresa Bailey, the founder of the advocacy group Canadian Hockey Moms, were stunned.
We were initially disturbed and concerned, and now it's turning into more disbelief, outrage, totally questioning how things have been handled from the start. And the more we learn, the worse it seems to get.
Since the initial revelation, Canadians have learned that Hockey Canada settled the claim without asking the players to cooperate or holding any of them accountable. A parliamentary inquiry revealed that Hockey Canada has spent at least $5.5 million to pay out settlements in 21 cases. That includes allegations against members of the 2003 championship team, which had several players with long NHL careers. This week, the Globe and Mail newspaper uncovered a second secret fund, which was also set up using player registration fees. Canada's sports minister, Pascal Saint-Ange, said it was clear the organization views sexual assault as an insurance problem.
It's a terrible legacy, and we want to see change, and I stand by that. It's not only about reestablishing trust, it's about making a swift change, and it's expected quickly.
But at parliamentary hearings this week, Hockey Canada's interim chair, Andrea Skinner, defended the organization and said there was no need for a change in leadership.
Suggesting that toxic behavior is somehow a specific hockey problem, or to scapegoat hockey as a centerpiece for toxic culture, is, in my opinion, counterproductive.
Skinner warned there could be consequences for young players if the leadership resigns.
Will the lights stay on the rink? I don't know. We can't predict that, and to me, that's not a risk worth taking.
The federal government has tried to deal with the issue by freezing funding to the organization. After the hearing, Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau told reporters he was flabbergasted.
It boggles the mind that Hockey Canada is continuing to dig in its heels. Hockey is a really important sport to a lot of Canadians and a lot of kids, and right now this mess is doing no favors to kids across the country.
Since the hearing, the hockey organizations in Ontario and Quebec announced they're withdrawing their support for Hockey Canada. This morning, three of its biggest corporate sponsors, including Scotiabank and the iconic Canadian donut shop chain Tim Hortons, also withdrew their sponsorship. For The World, I'm Anita Elash in Toronto.
The Nobel Prize in Literature was announced today. It went to French writer Annie Ernaux. Ernaux is 82 and has been writing for 5 decades. She's known for her autobiographical fiction, delving into issues of class, gender, and sex in France of the 1940s. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has more.
Annie Ernaux is an unusual writer. She's a memoirist who doesn't trust memory. Alison Strayer translated Ernaux's best-known book, The Years, into English.
The Years left me with a sort of blueprint of how memory works. Time and memory are always unpredictable, I think.
Ernaux's books are short, rarely more than 100 pages. She's written more than 20 of them, and they can almost be read together like one long autobiography. Sometimes she'll write in the first person and then switch to writing about herself from a distance. She's like a detective trying to crack an unsolved case, her own past.
There is one memory in The Years of she walks by the same place in Yvetot, her village, and she always remembers seeing a little girl joyfully stomping her foot in the mud, taking her foot out, and just seeing the imprint it left. And every time she walks past that place on the way to school and on the way back to school, she thinks of that little girl who's not related to her. But why is that memory? Why does that memory remain? But we've all got memories like that.
Ernaux's books explore intimate experiences, too. In Happening, she talks about an illegal abortion she had in 1963. She describes going to someone for help, an activist for women's reproductive rights. He tries to sleep with her and then turns her away. But in this book and all her books, Ernaux doesn't just reflect on her own personal experience. She's also digging into the cultural beliefs of the times. Here's Ernaux speaking at a literary event a couple of years ago in Paris.
C'est un livre que j'ai mûri pendant de très longues années.
I knew with certainty that the story of a woman's story, my story, couldn't be told without the surrounding history, that we couldn't have the history as a sort of optional extra.
In some of her first comments today, Annie Ernaux highlighted our current cultural moment. She mentioned women's rights to abortion and contraception. I'll fight to my last breath, she said, so that women can choose to be a mother or not to be. In the lead up to the prize, there was a pressure campaign of sorts to award it to Salman Rushdie, who's faced threats from Islamic extremists for years. Rushdie was stabbed on stage in August and is still recovering. But Alex Shepard, who writes about the Nobel Prize at the New Republic, says the committee isn't in the habit of making overt political statements.
The Academy has just not really ever worked that way. It certainly made some political-ish statements. Orhan Pamuk was given the Nobel Prize after being persecuted by the Turkish state. Harold Pinter was given the prize after being a sort of vocal opponent to the Iraq War. But those are exceptions, and even then, there are slightly more opaque political statements.
Shepard says the Royal Swedish Academy is making a bit of a political statement by giving the prize to Ernaux, but there's a lot more to it, he says. After all, Ernaux reinvented the genre of memoir writing, and she's inspired a whole generation of writers. Annie Ernaux is often described as a female working-class Marcel Proust, one of the most influential authors of the 20th century. The big difference, of course, Proust never won the Nobel. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Coming up, the White House told a Middle Eastern ally not to cut oil production, but Saudi Arabia went ahead and did it anyway.
I'm sure there's enormous frustration and quite a bit of anger in this decision.
The Saudi-U.S. relationship at a speed bump or a crossroads? That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. More than 500,000 people in the U.S. have legal status through the program called DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. These are people who were brought to the U.S. as children. DACA was established under the Obama administration and gives some undocumented immigrants protection from deportation and a work permit. But yesterday, DACA was ruled illegal by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. The program continues for now, but the case was sent back to a lower court in Texas. Here to talk us through the latest ruling is reporter Elisa Resnick with station KJZZ in Phoenix. Elisa, let's start with the basics. Why was the DACA program called into question legally?
This is a case that began in Texas, and it dates back to 2018. Texas and several other states sought to challenge the legality of DACA in their suit, and it's been making its way through the courts ever since. In the summer of 2021, a U.S. District Court in Texas ruled the program was illegally created under Obama. And under that ruling, current DACA recipients were allowed to keep their status and renew it when necessary, but new applicants were barred from applying. So that's how the case wound up in the Fifth Circuit. The three-judge panel there heard oral arguments for the case earlier this year and just yesterday made its ruling.
Got it. So the Fifth Circuit ruled in favor of Texas and the other states, but then sent it back to the lower court. Why did it move down rather than up to the Supreme Court?
So the Obama administration established DACA through an executive action in 2012 and outlined its parameters in a DHS memo. Now, this process is not a federal rule change, and it's not a law. And it was the memo that the Texas court ruled to be illegal. But now the Biden administration has issued its own guidance on DACA that goes into effect at the end of this month. This was done through a federal rule change. It's a different process that requires a public comment period. Come October 31st, this new rule will replace the 2012 memo. So even though the Fifth Circuit judge ruled in favor of Texas, they sent the case back to the lower court. They say the Biden administration's new rule must be considered because it essentially nullifies the 2012 memo.
The DACA program has been in limbo for a really long time. I mean, just on the ground, where does the ruling leave DACA recipients now?
So under the new ruling, current recipients, about 600,000 of them, are allowed to keep their status and renew it. But just like that ruling in 2021, new applicants are still barred as the lower court considers the case. So on the ground, this is kind of more of a hurry up and wait type of scenario. You know, there's no real timeline on how long this could take. It's a very familiar limbo for people with this status. Some of the DACA recipients I've talked to after the ruling have said they do feel a relief, you know, knowing there's more time to at least have that work permit and protection from deportation. Still, they tell me it's nowhere near a real solution. This status only lasts for 2 years, and it costs about $500 to reapply. It offers no pathway to permanent residency in the U.S., and it has not really been on solid ground for a long time.
So they're really suspended in time. It sounds like that's especially true for potential young beneficiaries of DACA, those first-time applicants, right?
That's right. You have to be 15 to apply for DACA, and the program has been in and out of the courts so much over the last several years that many people have aged into the program but are barred from applying. You know, really, first-time applicants haven't consistently been able to apply since 2017 because of this legal wrangling. You know, I talked to a DACA recipient in Arizona named Jose Patino. He works with younger students, and he's had the status himself since 2012. These fellow DACA recipients and undocumented people that he works with now, he told me that it's really hard to talk to them after the ruling because there's just been so many different rulings. And especially with first-time applicants, there's just not a lot of advice that he can give them. Moreover, you know, even for himself, he says this ruling is a relief, but so temporary. He says the only way to really change that is to get this program out of the courts and turn it over to Congress to pass a permanent solution.
Elisa Resnick of station KJZZ in Phoenix, thanks very much for updating us on this latest ruling on DACA.
Thank you so much, Marco.
Oil for security, that has been the pillar of the Saudi-U.S. relationship for generations. But yesterday's announcement that Saudi Arabia is cutting back on oil production can be seen as a slap in the face to Washington. The White House had been pressuring the Saudis to keep their oil flowing to ease prices at the pump and keep up the pressure on Russian oil. So why did Saudi Arabia go ahead with its plans to cut back? To answer that, we turn to Kristen Dewan. She's a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. So Saudi Arabia, along with its OPEC Plus partners, are scaling back production. Kristen, why?
I think there's a number of different things to pull apart here, but maybe we can start on that very first broad proposition that you made, that the relationship is based on oil for security. And I think to some degree, there's been some anxiety or worry within our Gulf partners that we cannot or will not meet the security needs of the kingdom. So I think it is a big question whether this basic pattern of oil for security, you know, now that we see the Saudis taking this motion, which I think you're right, is a bit of a slap in the face to the Americans and the Biden administration, is going to stand.
Yeah. So help us understand what OPEC Plus is thinking. What is your read?
What they're saying is that there's a lot of uncertainty in the market, that's their argument, and that they want to kind of get ahead of things. But I think, again, that's either sort of a misreading or misrepresentation based on the extraordinary moment and the context in which this decision took place, which really is taking place in the context of the ongoing struggle with Russia and the impact that that's having on the broader energy security and energy markets.
So we know the Biden administration had gone to great lengths to satisfy Saudi Arabia. Biden met with the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, in July. What has been the reaction by the Biden White House to Saudi Arabia cutting back production, this announcement?
I'm sure there's enormous frustration and quite a bit of anger in this decision. I think there had been hopes from the Biden administration, especially on the tails of this visit to Saudi Arabia and meeting with the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, that there could be greater cooperation on energy security.
Is there anything else the White House can do at this point to pressure the Saudis to keep oil flowing at the desired rate, or has the administration tapped out its options?
It is going to have to be a rethink of the broader U.S.-Saudi relationship in the broader context of a nationalism that's evolved in Saudi Arabia, their desire and willingness to kind of pursue their own interests. And I think for the Saudis, they feel that their time horizon for doing that is really shortened by the energy transition, and they realize that they're going to have to get as much as they can from oil right now. So all of these things are really putting pressures on the relationship, and it's going to require a rethink.
What is the risk that this move to slow down oil output shifts Saudi Arabia further away from Washington and closer to Moscow or Beijing?
They have been signaling that they want to keep a degree of neutrality in this growing, what they term as polarization between the two powers of the United States and Russia. But I think in this case, you know, going to Europe and at a time when we know, especially Europe, is going to be going through a really difficult time this winter, and announcing, you know, the year-long expansion of their cooperation with Russia and oil markets is definitely a step in the wrong direction in that sense, and one that's not going to be well received by their Western partners.
Kristen Dewan is a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute. She joined us from Washington. Kristen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. In Ukraine, a dilemma for young people, keeping a semblance of joy in their lives while staying focused on the war effort. Some of them have volunteered to clear debris and are doing it to a techno beat.
Volunteering must be partly joyful, besides being useful.
Staying productive and enjoying yourself during wartime. Still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Mexico is a contradiction when it comes to guns. Gun laws there are strict, and yet there is a high rate of gun violence. Just yesterday, members of a criminal gang opened fire on a town hall in the southern Mexican state of Guerrero, killing 18 people, including the mayor. The Mexican government blames the U.S. for much of the gun violence inside its borders, and it's about to file a second lawsuit charging that U.S. gun dealers along the border are responsible for the flow of illegal weapons into Mexico. The first one, targeting American gun manufacturers, was dismissed just days ago by a U.S. federal judge. Joining me now to discuss all of this is Arturo Sarucan. He served as Mexico's ambassador to the United States from 2007 to 2013. Ambassador, why was the first lawsuit dismissed by the U.S. judge?
Well, it was evident to many of us who observed the decision by the Mexican government that this lawsuit was going to fail based on statute of limitations and a lot of legal precedent where it is extremely hard, if not impossible, to go after gun manufacturers. So even though the Mexican government, I think, knew this, it was sort of like a shot across the bow. It was sending a diplomatic message that Mexico was unwilling to let this continue to drag on, that successive U.S. governments have done little to curtail the flow of illicit weapons across the border.
So what is going to be different about the second lawsuit?
The first lawsuit was filed in Boston. This one is going to be filed in Arizona. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out why there are more gun shops on the border states with Mexico than Walmart in those states. It's simply an issue of demand for those guns coming across the border from Mexico. Arizona has had a history of gun shops, gun dealers that have illicitly sold weapons to proxy purchases for the criminal organizations in Mexico.
So-called straw buyers, right?
The straw buyers, the straw purchasers. And so what the Mexican government apparently is going to do now is the option that when I was ambassador, I had pursued, but obviously the clock ran out on us as a government in 2012, which was to litigate not against manufacturers, but to go after gun sellers, gun shows, gun shops with names, because that is where a lot of these guns are being illicitly sold to individuals who in the first place should not be allowed to purchase a weapon in the United States.
So Mexico's Ministry of Foreign Affairs estimates that 70% of the weapons trafficked into Mexico come from the U.S. Who is buying these guns in Mexico?
It's mainly organized crime. Mexico has very stringent gun purchasing laws. So most of this is going into organized crime. And by the way, the data of 70%, yes, it's the Mexican Foreign Ministry, but it's also based on the information provided by the Department of Justice and ATF in the United States. And it's related to weapons that are seized in Mexico and then successfully traced back to gun shops in the United States.
How do gun laws in Mexico compare to gun laws in the U.S.?
They're very strict. You have to go through a very rigorous process to be able to buy a gun. There are no carry laws. You can't have it with you in the car. It has to be in your home. They're limited to very small calibers. Obviously, you can't buy semi-automatic weapons. That's a no-go. You can buy a handgun, but those are even restricted to very small caliber weapons. So it's a very, very strict model and legal framework for acquiring guns. And there are no gun shops. You can't walk into a Walmart in Mexico and buy a gun. You can only buy it through one shop, which is within the Ministry of Defense.
So what is your take? Who should be held responsible for the flow of illegal guns into Mexico?
Look, this is one of those issues. You and I have talked about this in the past. This relationship is so complex, so interdependent. You know, mutual recriminations serve no one's interest. If one side points one finger at the other side of the border, there will inevitably always be three fingers pointing back in the other direction. This is one of these issues where there's co-responsibility. There's a joint responsibility. On the one hand, there's no doubt that gun regulations in the United States and the lack of ability to inspect outbound, southbound traffic feeds and has been feeding the criminal organizations of Mexico for a long time. And therefore, the United States has a very important responsibility. But at the same time, as I said, it's also Mexico's responsibility. Until very recently, customs in Mexico was driven more by obtaining revenue from customs than as a security or national security or border security agency. That has to change. Mexico has to do a much better job of inspecting inbound cargo and vehicles, which we don't do adequately. And second, what is one of Mexico's Achilles heels, which is the weak rule of law, impunity, corruption, which obviously allow organized crime to illicitly get their hands on weapons and use them to intimidate and repel the government's efforts to take them on.
Do you support these lawsuits Mexico is filing against U.S. gun makers? What's your opinion?
I do. I think the first one was a mistake in terms of how it was focused on gun manufacturers. I don't think that's the route. I think this one is a much better idea. This has greater potential traction, which is you go after the dealers, the gun shops with a specific name, a specific individual. And we have that information and we have that intel because of the successfully traced weapons that result from the sharing of information with U.S. authorities. So I think the second lawsuit has a greater possibility of traction, but I think it's still going to be an uphill battle.
Arturo Sarracan served as Mexico's ambassador to the United States from 2007 to 2013. He's currently the president of Sarracan and Associates. Thank you as always, Ambassador.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, Marco.
The humanitarian emergency in Haiti is not new, but the situation has gotten even worse in recent weeks. Violent gangs are blocking access to aid and other imports, including fuel. On top of that, Haiti's Ministry of Public Health announced this week that the country might be facing a new cholera outbreak. With no functional government and no security, many Haitians are wondering, is it time for another international intervention? The World's TV Saisaya reports.
Haiti is going through hell. This is how Velina Charlier describes what she's experiencing as a mother of four living in Port-au-Prince.
The entire country is controlled by gangs. For the past 3 weeks, is in complete lockdown. The ports are blocked. The border is blocked. So nothing is getting in the country.
She says people have trouble just getting the basics. Fuel, food, water.
Businesses are closing, hospitals are closing. At the moment, there is no school, so the kids are basically on house arrest. They don't go anywhere. I keep them at home.
For the last month, there have been protests in Haiti almost every day. This video was posted online yesterday. Velina Charlier says at this point, her family is focusing on surviving.
So what you do is that you go out only when it is absolutely necessary. I mean, you plan your day knowing that you may not come back home alive. So nobody is secured. There is no safe area. There is no safe city.
She says she's very concerned about her daughters because kidnapping and rape is a huge problem. Charlier, who's also a political activist, says corruption is out of control and the gangs are really running the show in Haiti.
The state is non-existent. The legislative and judiciary are dysfunctional.
Haiti's national police force is rudimentary. It has about 12,000 officers for a population of close to 12 million people. Harold Isaac is a local journalist who lives in Port-au-Prince. He says the police force is simply unable to control the gangs.
It's poorly equipped and poorly trained. So it's a tremendous challenge for the Haitian police to deal with not only gang violence, but everyday duties that they have.
He says the crisis in Haiti is unlike anything he's seen before. So I ask Isaac, should the international community intervene to try to help Haiti?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, honestly. You know, there are many voices in town and in around the country that are claiming that this situation is really exceptional. The degree of disruption is unbearable.
One of these voices is Joseph Pierre. He's a Haitian political scientist and a consultant for the World Bank. He says the international community has failed to respond to the crisis.
In Haiti, there is no political will, no technical capacity, no financial means to sort out the insecurity problem. So the only answer that we have is the international community.
A large-scale intervention in Haiti has not been discussed at the United Nations or among the Organization of American States. That might be because Haiti has a long and troubled history with foreign interventions. Many say they've done more harm than good. Velina Charlier, the activist, says sending foreign troops to Haiti is a terrible idea.
When we get an intervention from the UN, one of the big things is that they are supposed to help strengthening the institution. While in reality, when they leave, the situation is worse than it was before they arrived.
But the consultant, Joseph Pierre, says this time could be different if Haitians themselves take the lead.
This is not a mission that will be imposed from above, but this is a mission that will include Haitians who can help draft the plan.
Pierre says a smart plan for foreign intervention would focus only on security and on disarming the gangs, nothing else. It's a debate that many people in Haiti are talking about right now. But there seems to be consensus that Haitians need help and they want their ideas to be heard. For the World, I'm Tibisay Seya.
In the Gambia, in West Africa, dozens of children have died recently from kidney problems. The World Health Organization is pointing the finger at contaminated cough syrup made in India. Here's WHO Director Tedros Ghebreyesus yesterday.
WHO recommends all countries detect and remove these products from circulation to prevent further harm to patients.
Our next guest says what happened in the Gambia is not an isolated case. Dinesh Thacker is a former pharmaceutical executive and author of the new book, The Truth Pill, The Myth of Drug Regulation in India. What was your reaction when you heard about the deaths of these dozens of children in the Gambia being tied to cough syrup made in India by the company Maiden Pharmaceuticals?
Well, it's terrible. I mean, it's an awful thing to hear about anything of this nature. I mean, 66 children. This is poison, if nothing else. But this is something that could very easily have been avoided if the regulators worked as they were intended or supposed to work.
So what is the latest known about why this cough syrup was deadly?
So, you know, from what the WHO has told us so far, is that they say that these four products, they were adulterated with a chemical called diethylene glycol, which should not be a part of any medicine. It is actually used to make brake fluid in cars.
And what purpose does it serve in a cough syrup? What purpose could it possibly serve?
The source of ethylene glycol, which is an acceptable chemical to be used in the manufacturing process, is very similar. The reason why you use ethylene glycol is if you want to make it easier for children to be able to take medicine, you make a syrup out of it. You make it taste like grape or a cherry or something like that, right? So ethylene glycol is a solvent. It dissolves the medicine, the active ingredient, and actually makes it easier for parents to administer that to children. In this particular case, it appears that the company essentially took one for another, and they got brake fluid in the medicine, which obviously, you know, stops your kidneys from functioning. And then, you know, that's how you die.
Dinesh, you became a whistleblower, revealing some 20 years ago that your company at the time, Ranbaxy Laboratories, had been falsifying drug data and violating safety regulations. So in your view, with what happened in the Gambia and the Made in Pharmaceuticals products, whose failure is this, the company or the regulatory system or both?
Well, it's a combination of failures at multiple points, Marco. Let me just tell you a little bit about how this process works, right? India and China largely produce a lot of medicine that's consumed in third world, Africa, Southeast Asia, South America. And the WHO kind of plays like a broker role in the sense that if the country doesn't have a regulator or the capacity to regulate, the World Health Organization basically comes in and says, we will give this company located in India a certificate, right? We've inspected their facilities. So that when countries in Africa, like Gambia, purchase medicine, they have some confidence that they're getting a quality product. Well, the way WHO works is that it relies on the national regulators of countries where these factories are located, where these manufacturing facilities are located. They rely upon the local regulator to police the system, you know, within the country. And basically what has happened is that process failed. The Indian regulator did not do its job. It did not protect, you know, the quality of products that one of its companies was exporting out, you know, to Gambia. And you can see, you know, it's a heart-wrenching tragedy that 66 parents don't have the children today.
So too late for the tragic deaths of these children in the Gambia, but the head of the WHO said his agency was conducting an investigation with Indian regulators and the company that made the cough syrups. What do you expect to come of that investigation?
I don't know. I mean, I don't have a lot of confidence, given what I know about how regulators work in this part of the world, that anything meaningful will come out of it. But we'll have to wait and see if the WHO is making this public pronouncement that they will do an investigation. I'd like to give them the benefit of doubt and see what they come back with. I mean, this is not something that's brain surgery. You know, this is something that's preventable.
What kind of recourse do the Gambian victims of this tragedy have now? Can they sue the cough syrup manufacturer?
I don't know. I mean, this is jurisdictional issues, right? How will this actually work out in the future? I don't know. I think we'll have to wait and see how things work.
Dinesh Thacker, you've been advocating for better regulation systems for Indian drugs for more than a decade. Have you seen any improvements in that time? And if not, what do you think still needs to happen?
Well, sadly, Marco, I have to say that I have not. Our drug supply in the United States have improved significantly, but not for people who live in the third world. I went down the way of trying to work with the governments to make them understand how important it is for public health to have a secure drug supply. That hasn't worked. I'd gone to court to litigate. That hasn't worked. So the only option, you know, in front of me right now is to write a book and educate people about, you know, how these things work. And hopefully, you know, that should lead to some kind of change.
What's been the reaction in India to this news from the Gambia?
Well, it's playing on pretty much every television and news channel at this point in time. But like many of these things that I've seen in the past, it becomes a news story for a few days and then it just goes off of, you know, people's attention. And I just hope it doesn't happen this time.
Dinesh Thacker is a public health activist and author of the new book, The Truth Pill, The Myth of Drug Regulation in India. He joined us from Gurugram, India. Maiden Pharmaceuticals and India's Central Drug Standard Control Organization did not respond to requests for comment before airtime. Dinesh, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Marco.
Tensions are rising in Asia. Both North Korea and the United States have been firing missiles into the sea, threats and intimidation from both sides. Today, North Korea launched two more missiles. That was in response to the U.S. and South Korea firing their own missiles at mock targets in waters not far from North Korea's coastline. And that was a response to a North Korean missile over Japan on Tuesday. Round and round we go. There's also now an American aircraft carrier sailing close to the Korean Peninsula. That's a rare deployment. The World's Patrick Wynn has been following these developments and joins us from Tokyo. This seems to be escalating by the day. So what is North Korean leader Kim Jong-un trying to achieve here?
Well, North Korean statements say explicitly they are doing this to make the U.S. and South Korea back off. South Korea and the U.S. have been holding war games that include practicing, quote, decapitation operations that would attempt to knock out North Korea's leadership if such an operation were carried out. So North Korea is responding, but really, North Korea has been firing missiles all year, almost every week, and the caliber of weapons is picking up. And what North Korea wants, again, just looking at its statements, is to modernize its nuclear arsenal and perfect its ability to deliver nukes, potentially all the way to the U.S. And they're just in a testing stage right now. And it is quite tense. I mean, I think this is as tense as it's been in East Asia since 2017, before Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un started talking and calmed things down for a few years.
Right, for a few years. But since the Trump administration, talks with North Korea have been frozen. What are the chances all these missiles and all this tension could move to the negotiating table?
Short term, the odds are not good. Because North Korea is in this testing phase, they want to keep testing. U.S. and South Korean intelligence keep warning that North Korea's testing phase will crescendo with a underground detonation of a nuclear weapon. If that happens, it would be the first time that's happened since 2017. The White House says it's been trying to get Kim Jong-un's diplomats on the phone and that they can't get through. Part of the reason is because the U.S. won't offer to relieve sanctions before it goes into talks with Pyongyang. And so I think, Marco, the hope by U.S. strategists is that North Korea will eventually say, we can't take it anymore, we're giving up our nukes, but that strategy is just not panning out so far.
What about Russia and China, Patrick? I mean, they're both allies of North Korea. What role are they playing in the standoff right now?
You know, I think this is a situation where conflicts in other parts of the world are spilling over into this issue. So as you know, the U.S. and Russia are very much at odds over Ukraine. The U.S. and China are very much at odds over Taiwan. And so a conversation that would already be difficult, reigning in North Korea, becomes almost impossible at the UN level because America, Russia, China, and the main players can't get along in so many other arenas.
Patrick, I want to shift to a different subject and a tragic one. Your base is in Thailand, which is where we've learned about a horrific mass shooting at a daycare center. What do we know?
What we know is that a former police officer recently kicked off the force over a drug charge, went into a daycare and started this rampage with a pistol and a knife that killed 38 people, 24 of them being children. Then he drove home, killed his wife, and killed himself.
You've lived in Thailand for years, Patrick. How unusual is this sort of thing there?
Extremely unusual, Marco. I don't know what conclusions can be drawn from this tragedy at this point. I think right now the conversation in Thailand is less about blaming institutional forces, and it's just a mood of utter shock.
No doubt. Patrick Wynn, the world's Asia correspondent, currently on assignment in Tokyo. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Ever since Ukrainians faced the invasion from Russian forces, they've been hearing a frightening and devastating soundtrack. Air raid sirens, explosions, screams. Now one group of volunteers in Ukraine is working to replace all that with something else, the sound of raves, techno beats that accompany them as they work, cleaning up villages damaged in the fighting. The world's Bianca Hillier has a story.
Before the war, Dima Kirpa says, just like in many places around the world, rave culture was big in Ukraine. People went out to parties and danced the night away. Of course, all of that has changed. And even if people are in a relatively safe region, Kirpa says going out to a party doesn't feel right.
Because you understand that just 200 kilometers from you, there is a real war and people die every day and houses are destroyed. So it's not right.
The need for joy, though, is urgent. So this past spring, when Kirpa co-founded a volunteer group to help clean up destroyed villages, he wanted to incorporate some fun. The group, called Repair Together, hosts cleanup raves in regions around Kyiv. They set up a DJ amid the rubble, so while volunteers clear debris, they also dance and make new friends. In a live stream from a cleanup rave last month, you can see both activities happening simultaneously. Some volunteers help repair a brick wall with one hand and pump their fist to the beat with the other. One young woman has a Ukrainian flag draped around her shoulders as she sways to the music. Kirpa says these events are therapeutic, and they make the work more sustainable.
In order to repair all the things that unfortunately were destroyed, volunteering must become a lifestyle for our whole generation. And in order to do that, volunteering must be partly joyful, besides being useful.
Since April, Repair Together has cleaned up 16 villages, 200 houses, and 3 houses of culture. Those are public buildings that house things like libraries, children's theaters, and local choirs. Kirpa says he also has teams rebuilding 16 private homes right now. It's taken more than 3,000 volunteers to get the job done.
Mostly we have Ukrainians, but the initiative became international. For instance, we have one guy that arrived 3 days ago from Michigan. He is an experienced and professional carpenter.
Donations come from abroad, too. Kirpa says the group doesn't accept donations from Ukrainians because, in their opinion, those resources should be going toward defense, not reconstruction.
Because reconstruction is not about death or life, and defense and rehabilitation is about death and life.
For their part, Repair Together is going to continue cleaning up damaged villages and building new houses for locals. And they hope to bring a rave to more events along the way. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.